The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Exclude confession, exclude tangible evidence collected, or if you're on the prosecution side, seeking to oppose those motions, you learn the basics, the foundation for that in criminal procedure. So take it and take great interest in it, I would say. We're providing people teaching that in the fall. We have a visitor from, I believe, Southern Methodist, Jason Dominguez?
Texas Southern,
who's teaching, I think, a couple sections of it. Do you have a question?
So we've got Professor Coles, excellent, Professor Tsai, excellent, a Kim Todd course, Professor Baer, and Judge Barbera. They are husband and wife. He is a former prosecutor, now defender, and she is a judge on the Maryland Special Court of Appeal. Who else? Professor Kittry is teaching it, and I think there might be a professor to be determined.
No, I don't know Jason Dominguez, so I can't recommend him or not recommend him. Students who've taken Baer and Barbera like the fact that, well, first of all, the downside is they teach it, I believe, just one long night a week. But the students who take it say each class they are actually litigating motions to suppress evidence. So you are assigned to the defense or the prosecution, and you know, the judge, I think, is the judge, and you actually learn the cases and then litigate in class, which I think you can't beat that experience.
That's an evening class. It is open to part-time students have priority, but sometime in the next month or so, after registration is over and after finals are over, it is then open to full-time students as well. And a lot of full-time students take the course. Professor Aronson is also teaching CRIMCO. He's a head of the CRIMCO teacher.
So does that mean that we can't try registering all this time around, or it's just that there's a limited amount of spaces?
Well, you cannot, if you're a full-time student, you cannot register for the part-time section for next semester. So I'd say just to keep your options open, pick the best full-time teacher section you can get into. And then if you really want Baer Barbera, when that opens up to full-time students in about a month or 6 weeks, then you can switch over.
So what the registrar's office does is, if the course has a maximum capacity of 90 students, they will set that capacity for registration purposes at like 60, knowing that there are 30 more slots. And so the part-time students can register for those 60 slots. And if it fills up with part-time students, then they'll open up the rest of the slots. So it's not that it's closed. It's that the enrollment has been artificially suppressed to prevent full-time students from taking the only section of CRIMPRO that nighttime students could take. If you really want a class, and this has definitely happened in my evidence class when there was a wait list of 70 people, inevitably people sort of say, okay, I didn't get in, I'm moving on. And then there are two or three slots. Somebody gets a job, somebody gets sick, and they have to drop out. And instead of my class having the maximum capacity of 100 students, it's 97 in the end. And three people could have gotten in. So if you really want the class, go to the class and keep going. And you'll probably, a couple people will probably get in. Now, don't sign a seating chart, you know, if you're already in. But just go and let the professor know, I'm hanging on to see if I can get in. And probably will be resolved in a week or so.
There's also a lot of drop and handle this summer. Just watch it every couple of days. If people decide that through current employment they should take a different course rather than whatever, whether it's a criminal course or something else, there's just so much movement over the summer. I would say in almost any class, even the large ones, there may be as much as 15% to 20% shift from the end of pre-registration, which is next week, until the end of the first week of classes, which is the end of dropping in.
And Liz Bowles is one of the other people who became involved. She was a public defender in Virginia for a number of years, and then she worked for a civil law firm. And now she is here as the assistant director of our trial ad program. I think she's phenomenal. She'd be a very good person to take if you're, especially if you're interested in litigating in the area of criminal law. So that's criminal procedure. Any questions about CRIMPRO? It's required, you gotta take it, take a section. There are, in every semester, a number of advanced criminal law and criminal procedure seminars. I teach one that goes out in the fall, race, crime, and politics. Angela Davis teaches one on criminal defense theories. Ira Robbins teaches one on post-conviction remedies. We have a bunch of adjuncts who teach different criminal law courses. Brenda Smith, who's in our clinic, actually teaches one about women in the criminal justice system, which it may or may not be filled, but she takes students, and you get to go to the prison in Alabama, you get to go to women who are in halfway houses, so it's combining experiential learning with some of the doctrine. That's a good class to take as well. So you should look through the different offerings. We have local defense attorneys and prosecutors from the Department of Justice and public defender offices who come in and teach a lot of criminal law seminars. Sometimes, I generally advise, sometimes during your second year, you should probably take a small seminar course for two reasons. One, Professor Robbins and I teach these big sections of crim law, and we get to know students, but we don't get to see what your research and writing skills are, and therefore we're not in the best possible position to provide you with a reference. So taking a small course with a crim law practitioner, one, they get to know your research and writing skills. Two, they have contacts, and they can, you know, connect you with friends of theirs, even if they're not hiring. And three, you probably want to try to complete your upper-level writing requirements sometime during your second year. And if you take a small class, you can do that. There are other ways to do that. Actually, one of my criminal law students came to me with an idea about doing an independent study to complete her upper-level requirement in the fall. I'm going to supervise her doing that. So if there's a specific topic that you're interested in, especially if it falls within the research area of one of the professors, you should approach them and see if they're willing to supervise you on your independent study. Her project dealt with wrongful convictions, which is my area. If your project deals with prisoners or prisoners' rights, that's Ira Robbins' area, or prosecutorial discretion and misconduct, that's Angela Davis' area. International criminal law, that's Nicholas Kitcher's area. So think about that when you're trying to figure out if you want to do, you can't find a class that covers a specific topic that you're interested in criminal law, and you want to do your independent study. Find a professor who may be willing to do that research with you. And if it's an area that they're interested in, they're going to be very interested in you doing all the work and getting the research together. They're like, you know, I kind of wanted to do that. Yeah, please, go do the research. I'll see the professor. Yeah.
Will both of your respective seminars be offered in the spring? Because I see that they're not the post-conviction remedy.
Post-conviction won't be offered next year at all. It'll probably offer in fall or fall.
Neither will risk on the politics. Because we're down two criminal law professors next year. Angela Davis will be on sabbatical, and Mary Fann is leaving. The existing criminal law professor, you can't have adjuncts teaching first year courses, so we have to kind of scramble and cover. Race, crime, and politics will be offered the following year, as will criminal defense theories and kind of post conviction.
Well, we have a good range of courses, even next semester, and I'll read the list of the ones that I think are relevant just for next.
That'd be helpful.
Okay. All right, so the advanced criminal procedure course is evidence, not just because I teach evidence, but because it is a critical course, both in law school generally, but definitely if you're going to practice criminal law. And it's a foundation course. In many clinics and in trial ad, they say evidence is a co-requisite. I think that is a horrible, horrible idea. I think it should be a prerequisite, and you should take evidence before you take any clinic and represent any client, and before you take trial ad. I've had students come up to me who were in my evidence class to say, Professor Jones, I have a trial next week. Can I come by your office and we can talk about hearsay? No, and you shouldn't be in trial with anyone if you don't know the hearsay rule. It's ridiculous to me. That's my own personal view. So I would suggest not taking trial ad in the fall while you're taking evidence. So either take evidence over the summer and then take a trial advocacy course in the fall, or take trial evidence in the fall and take trial ad in the spring. Criminal trial ad is only offered in the fall, civil in the spring. I have lobbied for them to change that rule. Why can't you offer both in the fall and both in the spring? And they're like, whoa. No good reason. I'm going to keep working on that. But it doesn't matter whether it's civil or criminal. You can ultimately take both. It is the skill set of getting up on your feet and arguing for the admissibility of evidence and direct examination and cross-examination. Civil trial ad in the fall, if you took evidence over the spring, over the summer, or taking civil in the spring semester, evidence in the fall, civil trial ed in the spring, and then taking criminal trial ed the fall semester of your third year. Not a problem at all. You should, I would say no matter what, you should take both. Every opportunity, if you want to be a criminal defense or prosecution person, you should take both of those classes.
Plus, tele-advocacy.
Yes.
Tele-advocacy is a low enrollment course. I think you're taking more than 7 or 8 students. You write a brief and you make an appellate argument. Our teacher, all of our teachers were applied advocates and grad staff. That course maybe you could hold to your third year. But if you know you want to be a litigator, you should take that course as well.
And at most, not most, in a number of prosecutor offices, federal and the U.S. Attorney's Office here, and at public defender offices, they require lawyers to do a rotation through the appellate division at some point during their career. The idea being, usually earlier in your career, you get to know the law in that jurisdiction before you're in court. So even if you ultimately think, I probably don't want to be an appellate litigator, I'm going to be a trial litigator, it would be helpful to have some additional appellate litigation training. Jennifer Lyman, I'm not sure if she's teaching appellate advocacy. She's a former public defender at UC Public Defender Service and has worked here as an adjunct in the clinic, as a visiting professor. I think she's excellent. And there are a few other people. I agree with Myra. I haven't heard any bad things about any of the appellate advocacy instructors.
And is appellate advocacy always offered in the fall and the spring?
And it may be easier to get an appellate advocacy in the spring because for people who are in moot court, it's required for the fall, so they're taking up a bunch of slots. For your purposes, if you're not in moot court and you're doing it for the experience, it doesn't matter what semester you take it in, so it's maybe easier to do. Externships. I'm a big fan of externships. I actually, Angela Davis was my externship supervisor when I was in law school. She was the deputy director of the Public Defender Service, and she supervised my externship. Shows how old she is. She'll admit it. But anyway, so I think there are a couple issues with externships. One, getting a good one, right? Students somehow think, especially in D.C. where you have this embarrassment of riches in terms of the number of places where you can be an extern, that, you know, God, I got an externship. It's like, no. You're volunteering free labor, right? You need to interview them. They want your services, too. You don't want to end up with this sort of prestigious-sounding externship, and you're running around photocopying and doing something that's really not giving you the depth of experience you want. So you probably, if you want to do an externship, need to start looking for, if you're going to do one in the fall, start looking over the summer. If you want to do one in the spring, start looking sometime late October, early November to find a good placement. Once you find a placement, then there's the externship class, which is 3 credits. The field experience component is 3 credits. Incredibly valuable. You can do, I think you can do 2 different externships during the course of your career. You can always, also just volunteer as a part-time person, not through getting credit, and just do it. But if you wanted to be a public defender or a prosecutor, I would be shocked and perplexed if you applied for a job and you never worked at the prosecutor's office or the public defender office. I wouldn't be able to take you seriously as a candidate. So if you want to do either of those things, getting experience working in those offices is critical.
But you can get that experience through the clinic as well.
Yes.
So would you suggest that students try to take both the externship and the clinic?
I would try to do an externship in the second year and the clinic in my third year. The clinic, every year it seems to change. Sometimes it's a full year. You can do it for the entire year. But I think depending on enrollment, they may say you can only do it for a semester, only fall or only spring. If you can do it for a full year, I would say, do it for a full year. I think they will not let you do a full year of prosecution. You can do a full year of defense, a semester of prosecution. It changes every year, so I don't know what the rules are. So talk to Benny Miller. And we have a new clinician, Jenny Roberts, who's was also a public defender in Syracuse before she came here. She was a public defender in New York, and then she was a professor at Syracuse. She's a co-teacher with Benny Miller of the Criminal Justice Clinic. She teaches a course at a seminar on plea bargaining. I think it was offered the first time this semester. So that's another course to look at. I think she's pretty fantastic as well.
Let me just add with regard to taking clinics and taking externship. I'm not going to argue against them, but I'm going to point out to you that there is an issue you need to be aware of, and that is that while you need 86 credits to graduate from this law school, and depending on how many credits you're getting now for your first year elective, it probably means you'll need approximately 57 credits after this year. You can take no more than 12 credits that count as non-classroom credit. So, for example, if you're going to do moot court, part of moot court is not classroom credit. If you're doing journal, that's not classroom credit. If you're doing externship, that is the field placement part is not classroom credit. If you're doing independent research with a professor, that's not classroom credit. So you need to keep a tally to make sure you don't go over that limit.
Does the externship part, you know, they have like a seminar that goes with it, right? So how does the credit break?
Free and free.
Thanks.
I agree with everything that Professor Jones has said so far, and probably everything she's going to say, but I will qualify my agreement on the externship. The externship is the seminar and the field placement. The field placement is a crapshoot. You may well get an externship supervisor who is wonderful, like a law school professor, takes you under his or her wing and is a mentor, or you may get a person who doesn't have the time to teach you. And you're just going to shadow that person at best, and that's a waste of valuable credit. In addition, to the extent that students get a good field placement, their criticism, many of them, criticize the externship program because they find the externship seminar to be a waste of time. Basically, you just sit around and you compare war stories, and it's not as if this is an externship seminar for people in criminal law. Some of the externship seminars are just called issues in lawyering, right? And you have 12 people from all different field placements trying to persuade others that what they're doing is relevant when some of it, or a lot of it, has nothing to do with what other individuals are doing. So in my opinion, that's a downside, that you have to do the externship seminar just because you want an externship.
Yeah, actually, I'm on the externship advisory committee, and one of the things we're trying to do is to make the externship seminar more substantive and less war story, less externship light. So right now, you do have to take both. And as with legal rhetoric, some sections are better than others. The same is true with the externship seminar. Some sections are better than others. But the externship field component, by and large, I would say the students I've talked to have done their research, and there's a book up in the externship office on the fourth floor where you can go through and see what students have thought about a particular placement in the past. They don't put that online because they don't want employers to say, really, every student from WCO thought my supervision sucked? But, so you can do that, but do your homework and pick a good one, where everyone said, yes, this was a great office. I remember there was a while where a bunch of students went to the Department of Justice at the Violence Against Women section, and everybody said it was horrible. I don't know why, whether it was a particular person who was there, but that was a bad placement. Not that the office was bad, it was just a bad field placement. So you need to do your homework, as I said before, and find a good placement. And again, you're trying to get a feel for exactly what am I going to be doing, and who's going to be supervising me, and do I sense that this person will have an interest in it.
So when you said 3 and 3 in terms of the credit breakdown, let's say that you didn't want 6 credits in your schedule going to externship, but you were doing an externship. Could you take maybe the 3-credit seminar, 1 credit of you know, an externship, which is however many hours, and then the rest of the hours that you spend there, if your placement requires more, are like pro bono hours? Or
think you could do that.
Why would you want to do that? Seems to me, if you want to cut back on the credits, you'd want to cut back not on the field placement, but on the seminar.
But if you want to do an externship, then you don't have a choice of doing that, right? You can't cut
only
back on
for
it.
The first time. You have to take the 3-credit seminar. After that, you can do supervision.
Well, let me just react in a different way. Whether you get 1, 2, or 3 credits for the field placement, you're going to be putting in the same amount of work. So why wouldn't you want your credit to reflect the work?
I mean, I guess if it was pushing out a class you wanted to take because that's 6 credits in your schedule.
Or it's not that you can only take 12 credits kind of thing. You have some flexibility before you have to pay more. You can take, what, 15 or 16?
You can take up to 16 without getting special permission from the dean's office. And even if you want to go over 16 and got special permission, you wouldn't have to pay more. On the other hand, of course, go to more than 15 or 16 is probably not in my case.
Do you have a question?
Yeah, I was just wondering what your views are on judicial externships.
Yeah, we're going to get to that next. With a public defender, prosecutor, I would strongly encourage you to do a judicial externship for a couple reasons. One, I clerked, and Ira clerked as well, Professor Robbins clerked. And I think it's a great bridge between law school and practice. I learned a lot from the judge I worked for. I learned a lot from the experience about how judges decide motions and how they decide cases and standards of review and all those kinds of things. I clerked on the appellate court. I've had many students clerk on state and federal courts, on state and federal courts. And in this economy, the one place where they're definitely hiring will be judges. They're going to hire, unless they retain their prior clerks, they're going to have this turnover. So it's kind of good to do that in law school to see whether you want to do it, to make contacts with a jurist who may hire you or recommend you to someone else. Kind of strategically good all around. The only downside, I would say, to a judicial internship is if you get a horrible judge. Some obnoxious jerk, either whose views are so, you know, counter to yours that you just have a hard time working with this person, or because they're not taking the time to mentor you and make sure you have a good educational experience. Again, talking to students who interned or clerked with them in the past and or doing your homework to see about this person before you accept an externship at their jobs. So I would recommend it. I would definitely recommend it. And it doesn't have to be. And just to be clear, you don't have to do it through the whole for credit program. I mean, it could just be just your part-time pro bono aid that you do. If you want to. But I agree with Ira. Why wouldn't you want to get the credits? You know, just get the credits the first time. All right. So those are the sort of the key components that I see for second year. How many of you are doing moot court, mock trial, or journal? Okay. How many of you want to be litigators? Okay. So, I mean, if you haven't decided on moot court or mock trial, there are some other opportunities for you to get that experience, but if you want to be a litigator, you probably should try to get that litigation experience. I've been on the faculty committee that supervises students in appellate arguments and in trial competitions, and it is, you know, it's a pretty intense period of time. Most of the moot court competitions, almost all of them, I would say 90% of them are in the spring semester. So even though you're all in that society, you probably don't have a competition until the spring. The problems come out sometime in February, and you have 2 to 3 weeks to write a brief. You're on a team of 2 to 3 people, and you write a brief. And then there's about 2 to 3 weeks prior to the competition when you're being mooted. There's a faculty member assigned as your coach, and they bring in folks, and you have at least 8 different moots. So it's a pretty intense period of time between late February and probably 2 weeks after spring break. But it's an incredible experience, and it's even more intense for trial ad because it takes an entire day almost to go through the entire trial and to get the critique. So whereas the mooting experience, each moot is probably 2.5 hours. The trial ad experience takes a lot longer to have a trial than it does to do an appellate argument. So I would encourage you, if you are not in one of those societies and you want to be a litigator, think about trying out next year to join one of those. I think it would be a valuable experience. Any questions about the stuff on this side of the board?
How important would you say taking advanced crim pro would be? Is it just like sort of like building upon what we learned in crim pro, or is it like?
It's a different course, and it's not. There are 2 things. One, it's not offered regularly, and it's not taught by.
Finish your sentence. I don't want to ask you a question.
It's not taught by one of the full-time faculty members.
When you talk about advanced crim pro.
Crim pro 2.
Crim pro 2. Okay. We have a separate course called advanced crim pro. That's not what we're talking about now. This one here is Criminal Procedure 2,
okay.
Which is which is non-constitutional criminal procedure. Crim Pro 1 is constitutional criminal procedure. Crim Pro 2 is non-constitutional criminal procedure. Never offered in the fall, always offered in the spring. Probably the most important thing I'm going to tell you, maybe one or two other things, but none more important than that. Unlike other areas of concentration in the law school, there's no fixed sequencing for people interested in criminal law. In our opinion, probably our colleagues' opinion as well, you should definitely have evidence either this summer or in the fall, not later than the fall. And in my opinion, the only other really requirement, although it's not required, the only other real requirement is you should have Crim Pro 2 next spring. Other than that, there's a whole range of courses, mix and match, take at least one criminal-related course each semester. And I'll get more specific advice in a bit. But Crim Pro 2, in my opinion, is really important.
So Crim Pro 1 deals with the restrictions that the Constitution puts on police officers in investigating crime. And Crim Pro 2 deals with the procedures that must be followed during the adjudication phase, that trial. How long a person, the speedy trial and disclosure of exculpatory evidence and those kinds of things. So they're very different. It's not necessarily building upon it. It's what rights an individual, an accused has at the investigative stage and then at the adjudication stage.
That, of course, is sometimes affectionately known as the bail to jail course, where you learn about grand jury, bail, sentencing, related things, but not the constitutional aspect.
Or as the public defender service used to call it, bail to not guilty. So it's a different kind of thing.
Public defenders engage in a lot of disappointment and delusion.
Sometimes victory.
Yeah, about, you were talking about, certainly taking evidence before clinic, but about taking evidence before trial ad. I was just wondering, though, wouldn't kind of the flip side of that be then, if you were to take evidence before trial ad, then you couldn't really take trial ad before clinic in your third year? I mean,
take evidence in the fall, criminal trial advocacy in the spring.
No, civil
trial advocacy in the spring, and then criminal trial advocacy the fall of your third year.
With clinic.
We've already had evidence and one trial ad.
Right,
course
and you're already.
There's nothing wrong with taking clinic and trial ad at the same time. That's actually how I did it. The point is to have evidence before you do either of those things. If you can't get evidence in the fall, then take evidence in the spring.
Do you think that's a likely scenario that it's hard for 2Ls to get into evidence in the fall?
It's not hard for 2Ls to get into evidence. It's hard for 2Ls to get into my evidence.
That's true.
That's reality. I mean, there was this scuttlebutt saying, you should wait to take evidence to your third year because it's on the bar and it's a good review for the bar. It's a horrible advice because evidence is also a prerequisite for other things. So as a result, a bunch of third years started waiting until their last year to take it. And it's sort of, as much as David Jaffe and I try to debunk that, I end up having, of the 99 students, 75 of them are third years. And I'm thinking, you're taking up slots for second years. Why didn't you take this last year? That's what it is. I mean, so some second years will be in there, but the class is always, my class so is two-thirds third years. And there are probably 300 slots of evidence. It can't be that you can't get into an evidence class.
But so then the other 2 seconds are shown as like 60 and 70, and that's because they're saving slots for.
Okay.
I have a question about a clinic, actually. The credits for clinic are classroom credits or non-classroom credits?
Clinic is like externship. You've got the clinic seminar plus the field work, so it's a combination.
Thank you.
You want to talk about advanced recommendations you have?
I'd like to talk about that. Okay, so I printed out the course roster for the fall, just going over it and highlighting the courses that I think should be on your radar screen as criminal law, criminal procedure courses, or criminal law, criminal procedure related courses. Now, if you looked at this schedule, you'd think, well, there's not really a wealth of criminal law courses there. But when you consider the courses that are related to that, the courses that focus more on people than on business, realize that there's plenty here just in the fall semester. But before I give you the list here, I just want to put in a plug for one's course. I'm serious. It's not mine. It's not hers. We don't need to put in a plug for our course. There is a death penalty course taught in the fall semester.
Yes, Stacy, we're going to tell people. She's like, tell people. I won't get in. We're telling people.
We have a death penalty seminar here probably every year, three semesters or so. The reason I want to put in a plug for this one is that it is being taught by the single best death penalty lawyer in the United States. Stephen Bright, who is the director of the Southern Center on Human Rights, and teaches this course at Yale, is also teaching the course here in the fall semester. This is a one-time deal. Well, not one time, but the last time he did it was probably 7 or 8 years ago. He's offering it in concentrated form. It is in 3 weeks, the whole course in 3 weeks, starting at the beginning of the semester. I looked this morning and it had 18 slots, 13 of which were taken. It may well fill up before you pre-roll, but watch that one. It, just as there will be dropping and adding from other courses, there will be for this one as well. If you can get that one, take it. We may well have a death penalty course in your third year, but he won't be teaching it. You would take that course not just for the subject matter, but because it's taught by the preeminent death penalty lawyer in the United States, whose name is sometimes not on the short list, but on a long list of possible Supreme Court nominees. He'd be a fight to get through without a filibuster, but he is absolutely great. Most of the faculty, certainly the criminal justice faculty here, know him very well. It would be a mistake if you could get into that course to not take that course.
And that's whether you want to be a prosecutor or a defender. He is just a phenomenal lecturer, and you would probably walk away thinking, well, this is one of those experiences I'll never forget.
And thinking, why can't all the professors here be like that?
In addition, there are other courses occasionally that we offer that are this concentrated time period at the beginning of the semester. People have done that when they were in one of my classes, and you just simply excuse the student so that they can take that class during those initial classes. There's nothing they can do. You can't change your class time. And I've taped classes during that brief period of time when they couldn't be there because of the concentrated class. So it's going to interfere probably with something else on your schedule.
Is it every day?
It's 10 to 12:30.
August 23rd to 27th, September 1st and 2nd, 8th and 10th, from 10 to 12:30.
So
it's law 702. Just want to find it in the schedule. It's law 702.
So you might have a class that starts at 11 o'clock. You may miss that class, or at least an hour of that class, during that intense period of time. Explain to the professor up front you're taking this class, that complex will be done in a couple of weeks, ask if they can tape it, that kind of thing.
Okay, so I'll go down my list now. Just following the course sequence here. So we've got constitutional law, First Amendment. First Amendment, by and large, is criminal. Most of the First Amendment, many of the First Amendment issues come up in the criminal context. Obviously, evidence. National security in an age of terrorism. Terrorism is criminal related, even if we don't call it criminal, when these people into criminal courts, it's certainly criminal related. Domestic violence, juvenile law, children's legal rights. Anything with the word children or juvenile in it is criminal related. Although it's filled up, again, it will be open, it will be dropping that over some. Federal courts is a really important course. I put that on my A list for all students to take. But if you're interested in crim law, Fed Court is a must. And our two Fed Courts teachers, Professor Frost and Professor Vladek, are probably among the top 5 teachers in the school. I would not necessarily recommend it for first semester, but I would keep it on the radar screen for second semester or third year. I'm not just going to run down the list, then I'll take a question. Immigration law is a real specialty. But it's so intertwined with criminal law that you could have a wonderful practice to make immigration criminal law issues. Criminal trial advocacy, death penalty, women, crime, and the law, appellate advocacy. The seminar on white collar crime, I think, was the first course to fill up for next semester. It is probably one of the most popular, but not that it's the most popular course, it's got one of the most popular criminal law adjunct professors that we have. That always fills up. There may well be some movement in the next couple of months. And if you're looking for a crim law seminar, that could be a one to take. But he offers it every fall, so if you don't get it next semester, get it next year. We've got the Innocence Project here, Criminal Justice Clinic, but as Professor Jones says, that should be for third year. Advanced Topics in International Criminal Law and Procedure. A research seminar, the history of habeas corpus, which will sort of fill up the slack because I'm not teaching post-conviction, but post-conviction is really habeas corpus. But he's focusing, Professor Plattick is focusing not on, on how to practice it, but the history of habeas corpus, which is especially important when we look at habeas in the terrorism case. The Law of the Federal Prosecutor, Civil Rights and Remedies, and Evidentiary Foundations and Objections, which is something for which you should have evidence as a prerequisite. Now this is just one semester's worth. I've probably rattled off 12 or 14 courses, and we'll have another 12 or 14, not all of them the same, second semester. So you've got a rich variety. Your problem is not going to be, there aren't enough courses here, it's which one or two should I take in each semester.
One other thing on evidence, another person who's teaching evidence in the fall is Klein. He's teaching it Mondays and Wednesdays from 6 to 7:50. That may also be artificially suppressed for Park Press students. He's phenomenal. He was a Virginia trial judge, formerly a not prosecutor, public defender in private practice in Virginia. I recommended him to come here and teach. He's teaching for the first time this semester, and I've heard from 10 or 12 students in the class, they really like him. Teaches it in a very practical way, which is how I teach as well. So I would also recommend Judge Klein. Okay, so in addition to the things that Ira mentioned, there's another course, you have to take evidence first, so this is not for the fall, that was developed called Evidentiary Foundations. It's sort of like the practice component of evidence. So after you've taken evidence, the Evidentiary Foundations course, basically you get exercises and you practice the rules of evidence, how you object, how you keep evidence out, do what I call evidence blocking. Theory being that the person who wins the litigation is the one who can keep the most evidence out. And they teach you how to apply the rules of evidence in that class. There's a course called the Federal Prosecutor. I don't know a lot about that course, Eric. I don't know if you do. What I know about it is it's taught by folks from the Department of Justice. They actually have a small number of people. You go to the Department of Justice and have different prosecutors tell you about cases and theories of prosecution in different divisions at DOJ.
As far as I'm aware, they take five people from each of the law schools. So it's not just a WCL course, it's a Washington, D.C. course.
The Innocence Project, I'm on the board of the Innocence Project, and right now we're in a little bit of a fight with the Dean's office because they're offering the field component and not offering the seminar, and the seminar is a prerequisite for the field component. So I've got to go down there and explain that to them, and hopefully we can work that out. The class basically talks about the causes of wrongful convictions and some of the reforms that have occurred post-DNA revolution. And the field component, you're actually assigned to a case of a prisoner who's claiming that they were wrongly convicted, and you're investigating, and you're finding witnesses. And one of my students last semester went to Baltimore and interviewed a witness who recanted his trial testimony. And he's sitting there and goes, "Yeah, I lied, and I felt bad about it for years." And he's sitting there going, "Oh my God, what should I do? Is there a tape recorder? Come on!" And he's like using his phone to record the guy recanting his testimony. That case actually then got DNA to exonerate the guy, and the Innocence Project got Jones Day, and they're filing motions, and probably he'll be exonerated sometime in the coming months. So anyway, that doesn't happen every semester, I should say. It happens once every few years, but it's a worthwhile project. Another course I already mentioned, and I can't see that it's definitely being taught, bargaining and negotiations or negotiations and counseling, is that being taught?
That's a great course.
It's not specifically, I don't see this. Yeah, it's not being taught. It's not specifically a crim course, but the skill set of negotiations and bargaining is a lot about plea bargaining and trying to get sometimes you have to redefine what you consider a victory, whether you're a prosecutor or a defense attorney, and being able to negotiate with the other side in good faith and knowing how to negotiate. It's not just a matter of saying, dismiss the charges or we'll fall suit. It's like that's not really negotiation, sometimes an unarmed offense is better than an armed offense, and so that's the way you can work out. So that's another thing to think about. Advanced topics in international criminal law. We have a program that we started, I guess, a couple of years ago now at The Hague, where students can go over to The Hague for the summer into the International Criminal Court, and Susan Sakuda, who runs that program, is teaching this international criminal law course. That's definitely something to think about. And immigration law, just to echo what Ira said, when I was director of the Public Defender Service in D.C., we actually hired an immigration lawyer to come in on a consultant basis and go through the entire D.C. criminal code and list, basically set out the immigration consequences of a client's convicted of each of these offenses, which affects whether you go to trial, whether you plead, you know, whether this person's going to be deported as a result of it, what you think is a fantastic plea arrangement. It's like, I got the murder charges dismissed, and I got it knocked down to this deportable offense. So good news, you're no longer charged with murder. Bad news, you're going to be kicked out of the country. So like, that's not a good plea deal for that client. It is, I think, imperative, whether you're going to be a prosecutor or a defense attorney, that you take immigration law. It is now so inextricably intertwined with the practice. It would be virtually impossible for you to be effective. The other thing that I would recommend...
It's offered every semester, though.
Yeah, the other thing I would recommend is a course in forensics. It has become post, this sort of post-CSI time period we live in, especially today, it's going to be used more and more frequently. If you're thinking of practicing in a D.C. metropolitan area, D.C. is about to open its own crime lab. The FBI crime lab is here. And it has become an indispensable tool. Another thing that I did when I was director of the Public Defender Service, I sent a group of the lawyers back to an eighth grade science class. We hired this teacher, and she's like, okay.
That was advanced.
Like, she said, this is the double helix. And they sat there in class and learned what DNA was. I mean, we kind of know, but we're not science people. And then she swabbed their mouths, and they did the whole thing, and the gel, and the alleles, and all that. And so they then came back and then taught more lawyers, and then each year. So as a result, every time the government has DNA evidence in a criminal case, one of the forensically trained lawyers co-counsels that case with them. Cross-examining experts and putting on scientific testimony has become critical. So if they, I don't know whether they have those courses on main campus, but that's something to think about. Now you can take a certain number of classes on main campus. We don't have, I don't think, a forensic science class, and it's something we should think about offering. But that, I would say, if you're trying to round out and make yourself marketable, that would be great to have.
Let me talk about main campus for a second. As part of your 86 credits that you need to graduate, of course you can't take more than offer, you need at least a credit. Even if you're not in one of our joint degree programs, just by being a graduate student at AU, you are allowed to take up to 6 credits, which means 2 courses on the main campus, and those credits can count towards your law degree. So if you wanted to take, for example, 2 criminal justice courses there at the graduate level, you'd ask the registrar would check with a couple of criminal law faculty, almost certainly we would sign off on it, as long as it's not a course that's taught in the law school. One consequence is that although you'll get the credit for it, the grade won't carry over, won't be part of your grade point average. Another aspect of
so it. So you have to take a test grade.
But you get a grade, but it doesn't, you get a grade, but it won't appear on your transcript. It's not just pass fail. And if it were pass fail, their standards are different from ours, so graduates on the main campus, in effect, get an F if their grade is lower than a C, like ABC F. So you want to take it seriously, but it won't count for your grade point. But they've got courses there on court organization, court management, drug law, drug crimes, taught from a very different perspective. Not the narrow legal perspective, but some other broader or some other narrow perspective, but it's different from the law school perspective. But what most students don't know is that we'll give you credit, at least if the registrar comes to me, I'll sign off on it. If you are interested in criminal justice and you're going to be practicing criminal law in one of the large cities in this country, we'll give you credit for taking graduate level Spanish. That is certainly criminal justice related.
You guys have any questions? We have some time left. Yeah.
I'm a part-time evening student, so in the sequencing of stuff, if I can't get into evidence next fall, I mean, can I just sort of shift things?
Don't you have to take evidence? Don't you have to take courses this summer?
Yeah, but I'm going to The Hague to do that.
Okay.
So, yeah, just keep shifting. Sequence will work out, but okay. I wouldn't lose that sequencing.
Okay.
So it's just, you'll have more semesters, but just keep shifting.
Okay.
Basically, take evidence as soon as you can.
Okay.
And I think we've talked about all of these things other than the clinic. And I did the clinic, and when I did it, you had to do one semester of defense and one semester of prosecution. I don't know if you remember Jerry Glenn. My clinic partner and I were both sort of, you know, rah-rah public defender types, and we didn't want to do the prosecution semester because we were defenders. And we had to do it, and when we did it, of course, then we wanted to win. Also, I don't want to prosecute people. Poor people accused of crime. But if I'm going to be doing it, I do want to win. So it ended up being a more valuable experience than I thought it was going to be. I was going to hate every minute of it. But I was like, God, this winning thing against the only equipped public defender is kind of fun. So I would definitely recommend doing the criminal justice clinic. And when I was the public defender, when people would interview for a job, I would look at their resume. If they went to a law school that had a criminal justice clinic, and an externship program, and they never worked in a public defender office, and did do the criminal justice clinic. Why, when you didn't take the advantage of the opportunities to do exactly what we do here, should I hire you? So think about that. And the same thing with prosecutors. Yes.
What if you did one of the other clinics, like the women in the law clinic or domestic violence, not specifically the criminal law one, but...
I would ask, why do you want to work here if you didn't want to do this work while you're in law school? That doesn't eliminate you. I mean, I think the clinic experience is good, but I'd be curious as to why you wanted to do domestic violence cases as opposed to representing poor people accused of crime, which is what we do here. And you may have a very good reason. But the immigration clinic, I think there's a proposal now to break that out of the human rights clinic and make it its own separate clinic. That would be a phenomenal clinic to do. And would make you incredibly more marketable. The two things that I think would make you more marketable to prosecutor and public defender offices would be immigration and forensic science. Because everybody kind of comes, you know, I was in the court and I, you know, do this kind of thing. It's like, but the two specialties that they definitely will need in big offices and especially in small offices, somebody who knows immigration law and somebody who knows the forensic science. When DNA comes up, lawyers are like, it's science, it's math-like. We can write about it, but you're like, actually, I do understand that. And if you find a good forensic science course, I know that you can take courses at other law schools, and I know GW has a program. I don't know whether you have it on main campus, but GW definitely offers, not the law school, but the undergrad, as a forensic science series of courses, and when I was the public defender, I allowed my lawyers to go and take those courses at UW. So that's something to think about. If you don't know that science, it would be just a great piece of skill set having your arsenal.
I want to mention one other thing, and maybe you wouldn't expect this sort of advice in a criminal law advising session, but don't over-concentrate on criminal law. If you want to be a criminal lawyer, you become an expert in criminal law, prosecution, defense, or whatever. But first, be a good lawyer. And in my opinion, and the opinion of a lot of my colleagues, I don't know if you agree or not, that there are at least some other courses that all law students should take, what I call the non-required required courses. One of them is evidence. Clearly, you want that for criminal law anyway. Another one is federal personal income tax. A really important course. It's not about how to fill out your tax form. It's about, well, first of all, it's a code course. You need to learn how to deal with statutes, and that's the ultimate code course. But it's when taught the right way, and we have all good tax teachers here, it's really a social welfare course. How you can affect things that we allow or we don't allow in our country by virtue of the incentives and disincentives you create in the tax code. So I would say the non-required courses are evidence, federal personal income tax, business associations, and wills. Oh my God, no. and federal courts. But the real thing here is twofold. One, be a good lawyer before you can be a good specialist in law. And number two, criminal lawyers, especially litigators, people who will make arguments to juries, need to tell stories. You need to know a lot about a lot of things. You should be well-read in a lot of area. Of course, in storytelling, I think that would help you. And prosecutors' offices and defenders' offices give training in how to tell stories. But just as I tell business students, take some people courses. I tell students interested in criminal law, take some of the institutional courses. Well, just to round out your education.
And civil rights, very closely tied. And, several organizations have now said, you know, the rights of the accused is one of the biggest civil rights challenges in America. So Fed courts taught certain ways is a civil rights course, but courses on suing the police and prosecutorial misconduct and things like that. Frequently you'll find that people want to sue because they've been wrongly convicted, wrongly arrested, beaten up by the cops, etc. Other questions you guys have? Well, thanks for coming. We'll hang out a little bit if you guys want to come up and ask questions individually.
Thank you.